cosa leggerai, con che libro affascini il tuo cuore, e se ti perderai nel labirinto di un amaro autore.
Ma i tuoi piedi, ta 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 ta, ma i tuoi piedi, ta 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 ta.
So, listening audience, this is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. Mark Gilmartin has been a guest before several times on this program, the last time in May, and he returns this afternoon. It's this afternoon in Seattle, and Mark is in Bellevue, Washington, but it's the evening in New York City, and so our theme is sex after sexual abuse, and Mark is going to look at, is recovery possible? And the focus really is men reclaiming healthy sex after sexual abuse. And I welcome you to the program, Mark. Before you start talking, I want to say that you are a licensed mental health counselor. You are a certified sex therapist, a certified group psychotherapist with a private practice in Bellevue, Washington. And Mark offers individual therapy, sex therapy, and therapy groups for men dealing with sexual health concerns. So officially, Mark, I welcome you to this program once again. It's really
Thank
good
you.
To have you back. Mark
Great.
And I are also, we are also friends. So it's
yes. Full disclosure.
Full disclosure.
Yes.
Right.
So
yeah,
I wanted
you
to,
just, yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I just, before we get into the topic, I wanted our listening audience to know that you have just returned from an ASECT conference, ASECT, American Association for Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists. And it was in Puerto Rico. And can you just spend a couple of minutes talking about that and what really stood out for you?
Sure. It was a great conference. It was there were lots of great, quite a diversity of presentations and some great panels as well. I think my favorite workshop was a workshop on the aging GLBT population and looking at sex and sexuality in that population as that population ages. And it was a fascinating bit of research that this particular researcher did and presented, looking at the different ways that couples express sexuality, gay and lesbian couples express sexuality in their later years. So it was very encouraging to hear the research and to hear the trends and also the range of different ways that couples express sexuality as they age. It was quite heartening, actually. So that was my last workshop of the week of being in Puerto Rico, and it was a really high note to end on.
Excellent, excellent. And you, Mark, you've been in practice since 2000.
Correct.
And it's been a real learning curve for you, and I know you're a very successful therapist. You recently did become certified as a sex therapist, and it's much harder to become certified as a sex therapist than it was when I did it. So they keep making it harder to get in, I guess.
Yes, it's quite a rigorous process, but I'm really glad they're raising the bar and making it more rigorous because I think it adds credibility to the profession.
Absolutely, and some, you know, it surprises me. There are very few people, but some, that think that a sex therapist can also be a surrogate. In other words, somebody who's going to be having sex with their client.
Yes.
And, of course, that would be very damaging for the client, and it's unethical to do that. And I can't imagine doing it, can you?
No, I can't. And there's a lot of confusion. I find that when I disclose or share with people that that's one of the focuses in my practice, there's a lot of misunderstanding. And I think we have some work to do as a profession in educating not only other professionals, but the general public about what a sex therapist is, what they do, how they work with clients, what the constraints of our profession are, because there is quite a bit of misunderstanding that persists unfortunately.
It's really true. My daughter, who is a journalist, recently wrote a story that she's married to a Canadian, so they live in Victoria, B.C. But the story was my mom, the sex therapist, and back in the mid-90s when she was at Georgetown University, she would tell her classmates what her mother did for a living, and her classmates would often raise their eyebrows. She does what?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it just, there wasn't the understanding that it's all talk therapy, clothes are left on. But that came out in her piece, in addition to her initial embarrassment and how there was a shift. But
yeah.
So I am fully out as a sex therapist and a mother.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But let's get to the topic at hand,
sure.
Mark. So men reclaiming healthy sex after sexual abuse. So what's the first thing that you would like to address?
Well, the first thing I'd like to address
about healthy sex. Yeah.
Who are the boys and the teens that get sexually abused? I guess I would mm-hmm. also want to include that men can be victims of sexual abuse and rape, but I'm not going to focus on men that have that experience as adults, but rather boys and teens that experience sexual abuse or incest or non-consensual sex, meaning that they're not actually either of legal age where they can give consent or they are coerced into having a sexual experience. So who are mm-hmm. these boys and teens? What we find in the research is that sexual abuse and incest really cuts across racial categories, ethnicities, different faith communities, socioeconomic cultures. It really doesn't discriminate. The research shows us that about 1 in 6 boys or teenagers experience unwanted sexual contact before the age of 16. So it's a relatively mm-hmm. high number of men that have this experience, and it's a relatively invisible population, because if you think about that number, so what is that, about 15% of the population? You know, if we have a population of 280 million, let's say 140 million of those are men, you take 15%, you've got somewhere in the range between 20 and 30 million men in our country alone
yeah.
are sexual abuse survivors. Think about that number. You know, that's not really being addressed from a public health perspective. The men are not coming forward to get help. So where it shows up for you and I in our office is we may have a couple that comes in where they're having some kind of sexual health concern in the marriage or the relationship, and maybe as a matter of course in taking a history with these clients, we discover that there is a history of sexual abuse.
Yes, yes. And I just would like to remind the listeners that even though we're focusing on the male population, there are many, many parallels to female sexual abuse, although the numbers of girls molested, experiencing abuse, is even higher.
Yeah,
it's about one in three.
About double the amount. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are definitely...
So that's a lot.
Yeah, there are definitely parallels. I see two common presentations. Now, this isn't by any means representative of all men that experience sexual abuse, but I see two very common presentations, and one is of hypoactive sexual desire, meaning
yes.
Either a sexual aversion or just no interest or very low interest in sex. That's
mm-hmm.
one of the presentations that I see in my office. The other presentation I see is a hypersexual orientation, where a client has a very high frequency of sex, a high need for sex. They find themselves sexualizing lots of relationships. Now, I do want to differentiate between a hypersexual presentation versus someone who just has a high sex drive or a high libido. They can often look
mm-hmm.
similar, but they're quite different. The hypersexual presentation with a sexual abuse survivor, it's typically, it's what we would call ego-dystonic, meaning that they're actually not happy about the fact that they have that much sexual energy. They don't really want to be having that much sex, but they may feel compelled or driven or just continually in the pursuit of sex, even though they don't. That's not really how they want to be living their life. So it can look like someone who just naturally has a high sex drive, which can be a wonderful thing to have, but it's different. The two groups of men are different. So those are the two common clinical presentations that I see. And in my practice, I probably work mostly with the hypersexual population. And the reason for that is I think that those clients tend to seek out therapy because they run into more problems with their sexual expression. They may find they're getting in trouble for looking at sexual imagery at work, for example, or paying for sex, or maybe they're getting repeated sexually transmitted infections. The men that have the lower sexual desire, they're typically not that unhappy about it, and it typically only comes up when they have a partner who says, I want more sex, and the male partner says, yeah. Well, I don't really want more sex. So that tends to yeah. show up in my office less, although I'm sure there are plenty of there are a fair share of couples therapists that see this in their offices.
I do, in fact. And when it's more common with mismatched desire, as we
yes.
commonly call it,
right.
for the woman to have the lower desire, but occasionally it's the man.
Mm-hmm.
And I,
mm-hmm.
in the history, I always ask about, was there any sexual abuse? Because
right,
it's,
right.
it's often true. And especially if, as a boy, he was sexually abused by a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so this really, this man faces a particular form of confusion and even isolation that, because we have a society that seems to be celebrating, you know, the older woman with the younger boy.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so he's often somebody who does not want to risk talking about it. Haven't
yeah.
you found that to be true?
Right, right. The typical time for disclosure with a child sexual abuse survivor is about 20 years on average. So these men wait a long time to disclose. It's something they keep hidden for quite a while.
And while they're hiding it, the shame and the isolation often increases, does it not?
It does. It really.
Yes.
It can be terrible because there's such a I'm the only one kind of experience and feeling so alone in the experience. You know, even when you have a celebrity or somebody, there have been celebrities over time that have come out and acknowledged being sexual abuse survivors of famous athletes, musicians. Carlos Santana disclosed at one point that he was a sexual abuse survivor. Henry Miller, the author. You know, there's different people that have come out over time. But the problem is it doesn't stay in the public awareness very long. We tend as a culture not to not want to think about men being victimized. And so we brush it aside, or it gets a little bit of attention, and we seem to be happy to forget about it or not continue the dialogue about it.
Yeah.
So the other thing I wanted to comment on, with low
yes.
desire, there's also a subsection of men that actually just have a naturally occurring low desire. So, again, I wouldn't want to have people come away from this talk thinking that if you're with a man who has low desire, he may have some kind of sexual trauma in his background. Some
exactly.
men just are naturally wired to have a lower amount of desire. And typically
mm-hmm.
where that becomes problematic, again, is in a relationship where there is a desire discrepancy between a higher desire partner and the lower desire male. But if these men, some of them happen to just are fortunate enough to find other partners that also have low desire, so they don't necessarily have to focus a lot of their attention on the sexual relationship. It's typically a problem when they find a higher desire partner, and then they have to deal with the fact that they don't really want to have sex as much as their partner does. But it's not necessarily an indicator of a trauma history. I wanted to make that clarification.
I think that's valuable. And you and I both know that if two people have low desire, and they're content, we don't usually see them.
Right. There's no problem.
They're just fine.
They're fine. They're not coming in to see us. Yeah.
No, they aren't. But
the other comment I wanted to make here was about this idea of this belief in our culture that all non-consensual sex is traumatic. So again, the idea that if you were a survivor of incest or sexual abuse, you must have been traumatized. And it's actually been relatively newer research that has shown us that not all victims or survivors of these experiences feel traumatized. Some do. I would say a vast majority do, for sure. But there's probably a small subsection, maybe 10 to 15%. It's a little hard to dial in that figure, but it's probably in that range somewhere, that come away from the experiences and may have had a neutral experience or a positive experience. For some people, this is the only attention that they ever receive. It could have been the non-consensual sex could be part of a bigger picture where there was mentoring or nurturing or fostering of some kind of relationship where needs were not being met in their family of origin or in their community. So not everyone that experiences sexual abuse experiences trauma. So I wanted to underscore that point as well.
And that's important because it is pretty widespread belief that if any part of it was pleasurable, it's not really abuse. And, of course, the reality is quite different.
Yes.
Because there is no such thing as a, quote, willing victim, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
And because to be a victim is to have all your will destroyed. I mean, you're not a willing victim. And, you know, did you see the film Spotlight about...
I did, yeah.
Yeah, and that was very disturbing. And, of course, the film was very well done. Thus, it won... Did it win an Academy Award or did it win a nomination?
It won the Academy Award for the Best Picture last year.
Mm-hmm. Right, and...
Yep.
Yeah, and so it painted so many Catholic families that first had trusted the priest. He was almost like a god, another god.
Right.
And maybe the kid didn't have much father attention in the household.
Mm-hmm.
And then it sort of redoubled the suffering that these boys had because some of them may have enjoyed it, but also they were so glad to get the attention of the priest.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that particular area, which is pretty widespread?
Yeah, what you're talking about is this was the clergy sexual abuse scandal that really happened in the Archdiocese of Boston back in, I think it was the early 2000s, probably about 2001. There was a case where quite a large number of priests were discovered molesting parishioners and then being moved around from parish to parish. So it really does violate the sense of trust that a child has when they look to this person as a representation of God and a spiritual guide, a leader of sorts. And then to have that trust betrayed, it really can have quite a lasting impact. When I see these clients and they come in to see me, they have different motivations for treatment. And I always try to get clear about what is your motivation for being in therapy. Because not everybody that comes to me says, I want to have a better sex life. Somebody might say, I just don't want to have these flashbacks anymore. I don't want to feel traumatized when I drive past a church. So some of the work maybe is more trauma-focused, and some of it maybe is more focused on how is this still affecting you today? So for the clients, for the sake of our presentation today, I'm really addressing those clients that come in and say, I really want to have a better sex life, and I'm aware that my sexual abuse probably had an impact on me. So that's the premise that I'm going to work off of in speaking from this point on. So when I look at when I speak to clients, the first thing that we usually end up talking about is how they had to adapt to the sexual abuse experience. And the primary adaptation usually is leaving the scene of the crime. So if you think about somebody who's physically trapped having an experience, our bodies are amazingly capable to take us other places when we physically can't leave our own bodies. This is why when you talk to many trauma survivors, especially sexual abuse survivors, they may say, oh, well, I can sort of remember I was with my grandfather and he was touching me inappropriately, but I felt like I was floating up in the corner of the room, looking down, watching the whole experience. I didn't actually feel like I was in my body. Now, we know that they can't actually physically leave their body, but mentally and emotionally, we do have the ability to dissociate, which is the ability to go somewhere else in your mind so that you're not having the impact of whatever that physical experience is. So most of my clients have learned how to leave their bodies, how to not live inside their bodies, how to not inhabit their bodies. And what we know from the principles of sexual health is that you really need to be in your body in order to be able to enjoy sex. It's just a basic principle of sexual health. You've got to be able to be in your body. How can you know what's pleasurable or what you're sensing or how much sensation or pressure or what kind of experience you want to have if you can't be in the body where the experience is happening? So this is often a little bit of a conundrum when clients first come in to see me, because on the one hand, they're saying, I really want a better sex life. And on the other hand, they may be saying, but I don't really like living in my own body very much. That's where some really bad stuff happened to me. So I tend to not hang out in my own body very much. So there's a particular tension for them initially. I want better sex. I don't want to be in my body. So that's often a starting place. Where we start is identifying where the tension is for them around their particular treatment goals.
And sometimes it's held in the body in a particular place, if you're looking at it from a somatic point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. And so some of the work, oftentimes we have to identify there may be some obstacles or barriers that we have to address that are related to how you're holding your trauma in your body before we can actually help you come back in. So from a trauma perspective, one of the ways that trauma gets stored in the brain is it gets stored in a part of the brain that doesn't have any orientation to time. So the way that works is if somebody has an association or a flashback or they drive back past something that reminds them of their abuse, or they smell something that reminds them of their perpetrator, the brain can immediately, in a millisecond, take them right back to the experience of their abuse, and they can feel like it's happening all over again. Well, it's not happening all over again, but what happens is the part of the brain that's holding the trauma doesn't have any orientation to, this was 20 years ago, this was 30 years ago, this was 50 years ago. The brain just holds the trauma in a part of the brain that doesn't orient to time. So this is why people can have these intense flashbacks and they can feel like, oh, it's happening again, when it isn't. So oftentimes I have to do some trauma work, or I might refer a client out to do a short course of some intensive trauma therapy to help them resolve whatever that traumatic experience was. And the kind of outcome we're looking for, we can't ever erase the memory, but we can. Good trauma therapy can really pull the sting or the charge out of what the trauma memory is. So imagine looking at a TV where there's a war scene happening and it's loud and you're hearing gunshots ring out and people screaming and crying and yelling. And as the trauma therapy progresses, the volume on that TV gets lower and lower and lower until eventually you just look at the TV setting, you see a lot of stuff happening, but you're not hearing any sound. So the clients will retain
That's
the memories.
Very good.
But then they can say, but I just don't freak out about it anymore. There's some bad stuff that happened with my coach or with my priest or with my brother or my stepdad or my mother, for that matter. But I just don't feel it the same way. I just don't feel it in my body the same way. So that's often a starting point when treatment starts, is to really help the clients find a way to heal whatever that wound is, that persisting wound, so that they can then start considering, well, maybe if that wound is healed, maybe I could slowly start making my way back into my body. It becomes more of a possibility for them, but you really have to heal the wounds first. That's the first thing that needs to happen.
Heal the wound first, yes. And, of course, lots of parallels to PTSD therapy.
Well, it is PTSD therapy.
Yeah, it's really the same.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Whether you're in a car, a terrible car crash, or you're the victim of a violent crime, or you're some kind of natural disaster, an earthquake or a tornado, yes, these the PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder therapy is, it's the same kind of modality. So once clients are able to get back into their bodies or to start considering coming back into their bodies, then we can start working a little more with helping them find a way to safely re-enter their body. And it usually takes a little bit of time. It's not a fast process. I think of it as a kind of a titrating process. I might do some somatic kind of work with a client, somatic meaning experiential kinds of exercises that help them practice being in their body a little bit more. So it could be a progressive relaxation technique. It could be a particular kind of breathing technique. It could be something simple like sitting quietly with their feet on the floor, with their eyes closed, and slowly scanning through their body and just identifying the kinds of sensations that they're aware of in their body. Do they notice a busyness or a lot of activity in their mind? Do they notice hot or cold sensations? Do they have any pain in their body currently, or any muscle tension or stiffness or tightness? And for some clients, these trauma survivors, these kinds of exercises can oftentimes be the first time where they intentionally really made an effort to go into their body and look around. So you know, I might spend a little time doing that, and then I might spend the rest, maybe the next 45 minutes, really processing and deconstructing what it was like to go into their body for just a few minutes and what that was like for them. Because for many of them, they've been disembodied. They've been out of their bodies for decades. So it really can take some time to slowly come back into the body. Now, with the hypersexual clients, it's a little bit of a different process. Because they may, part of what they may be afraid of is this, how do they make peace with the fact that they seem to become aroused so easily, and they seem to become stimulated, and they seem to have very little impulse control once they're stimulated, and then, you know, making choices to engage sexually that maybe are not congruent with their own values or ethics or faith or a variety of other things. So we have to work a little differently with the clients that have the hypersexual presentation. Oftentimes, they're often eager to really dial down all this surplus sexual energy that they have, and there are things that we can do to help them manage that, but then they're often very reluctant to start figuring out what a healthy sexual presentation can look like. If we use the parallel of, let's say, somebody who's maybe always had some kind of food craving, some kind of sugar craving, and they finally found a way to control that sugar craving, and then someone says, well, let's now find a way to go out and really enjoy other different kinds of food. They might say, oh, no, I've had that monkey on my back for so many years. I eat my chicken and broccoli and rice, and I don't want to risk going back near something that was so problematic. So you have some of these men that are very often very reluctant to start thinking about what does a healthy sexual expression look like, because they're just so relieved to not feel driven to want to have sex all the time that they're sometimes content just to have more of a celibate or an abstinent orientation towards their sexual energy.
Mark, how do you treat masturbation with these guys who have hypersexuality?
Great question. I frame the dialogue about masturbation or solo sex a little bit differently. I try not to approach it from a moralistic or a value-based perspective, because there's such a diversity of what clients bring into my consulting room. I want to find out really their own sense of ethics and values initially. Because ultimately they have to live with the decisions that they make. So I really want to help them get clear about, you know, what are their own beliefs about solo sex or masturbation. This is often a good time to do some education. If they've heard things about you know, masturbation causes hair to grow on the palm of your hand, or you know, yeah, whatever mythology they've heard about it, I can work to correct some of that. But if it's a hypersexual person, they're usually not too worried about the hair growing because they do it so much. They probably would have had very hairy palms if that was indeed the case.
Yeah.
So the initial question I usually ask has to do with the framework of agreements. So I would ask somebody, what is your, if you're in a marriage or if you're in a relationship, what is your relationship or marital agreement about masturbation? And oftentimes I get a very blank stare at that point in the session where somebody will look at me, and I'll repeat the question, what's your agreement in your marriage or your relationship about masturbation? And they'll think about it and they say, well, we don't have an agreement. And I say, oh, okay, so this is one of the first questions, is there's no agreement in your relationship. That's going to be something that's probably going to need to be addressed at some point. And then I ask them, well, what's your agreement with yourself around this? So when you think about your own personal values, what kind of agreement do you want to have with yourself around this? So a part of the process is a values clarification process, finding out from them what is the importance of, is there an importance in not masturbating or limiting the amount of masturbating or masturbating only without the use of fantasy or masturbating maybe only in the presence of a partner or not masturbating ever. I think it's really important to do a values clarification conversation with them so they get clear about, well, what are my values around this? And then we can start working towards helping them live within the particular values that they've identified for themselves. And that's how I treat masturbation.
Okay. And so, yeah. But so you're not likely then to put a ban on it, as I've heard some sex therapy groups with sex offenders do, to put a ban
on it. Well, no, I don't work with any non-consensual sex. So if somebody is reporting a non-consensual sexual interest, such as having sex with minors, exposing themselves in public, peeping through windows, I would refer them out to somebody there. So I only am working with consensual sexual concerns. But no, I'm not going to be somebody who's going to mandate, but I'm happy to work with a client to set up appropriate boundaries and limits that that support their own values.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to do that, but I'm not going to prescribe my own agenda as far as what I think they should be doing. I think that's problematic, and I think clients have to answer to themselves. They don't need to answer to me. They have to answer to themselves. They have to sleep with themselves at night. So I'm really working
That's
to
right.
help them figure out what's important for you, and let's help you have the kind of personal integrity that you want to have. I wanted to bring up
I just wanted to comment on that, Mark.
Yeah.
That is a great example of healthy sexuality.
Yeah.
And just the way you're working. And so I applaud that.
Go ahead.
Well, we were gonna also talk about is all non-consensual sex traumatic?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the what if I enjoyed it? Because you get people like this. I do too. I used to work lots more with women with sexual abuse, but I still have some.
Mm-hmm.
So what if I enjoyed it?
Right. Well, I think, again, I mean, we're working with where the clients feel conflicted. So if they're not feeling conflicted about it, they might not bring it up, but they might need a little psychoeducation to understand that, you know, if you enjoyed it, or your body responded, if you're a man and your body responded by becoming erect, if you had an orgasm and an ejaculation, you know, and that was pleasurable for you, then it may not have been, you may have been of one of those small percentage of folks that didn't find the experience traumatic. Other people find that it feels like a little bit of a betrayal of the body when they're in their brain is saying, I don't want this. I know this is my sister, or this is my teacher, or, you know, this is my Boy Scout leader. But the body doesn't discriminate. You know, if you touch the body, if you stimulate the body doesn't discriminate between, oh, this is a safe person touching you and this is a not safe person. The brain distinguishes. the brain says, oh, mm-hmm. I don't want this. But the body, you know, if you massage the body in a particular way or you stimulate the genitals typically respond to stimulation. So that can be confusing. So I often will talk to clients about normalizing, however, whatever physiological response they had when they were molested so that so they can understand why that was so confusing for them. I wanted to take a minute and talk to you about one little subsection, which is a bit interesting, and that's this question of what if my some of my erotic interests happen to parallel or mirror some of my sexual abuse experiences?
Right.
So an example might be, what if you have a man who was forced to perform fellatio as a child or a teenager as part of his sexual abuse? And let's say that as an adult, he discovers that he's gay, and I should clarify here that there's no correlation between sexual abuse and sexual identity or orientation. There just isn't any good research showing that there's any correlation. But let's say that...
Wait, that's real. Pause there for a minute, because really important.
It is important, yeah,
for the listening audience to know, because there are so many... boys who are molested by another man who thinks, well, I must be gay, and then they're really conflicted if they're really basically heterosexual.
Yeah.
So, but there's no evidence, so it just seems to add the confusion and the shame, but go on. So,
it does. Well, so the science really shows us that the vast majority, I think the statistics are somewhere in the mid-90s, 90% of pedophiles are heterosexual. They identify as heterosexual. They're not gay. And so when they pursue, they're usually looking for vulnerable children. And oftentimes they don't discriminate between male or female. It's more around the power dynamic, really being able to overpower and have a sexual experience, at least with pedophilia, to have a sexual experience with a prepubescent child, a child that has that has not developed secondary sex characteristics like breasts or pubic hair, or these kinds of things. So, it definitely can be confusing, but there's no correlation a sexual abuse experience has any link to sexual identity or orientation. Now, that's not to say that sexual abuse can't influence sexual interests. We're still learning about erotic maps and templates and how people end up enjoying what they enjoy or what they're drawn to do sexually. And certainly, because these are formative years, sexual abuse may have an impact on that. We don't know enough about that, but we do know that it doesn't affect identity or orientation. These things are. They're believed to be hardwired and genetic and not influenced by social constraints. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, so again, if this example, you have a boy who's molested. He's forced to perform fellatio as a child. And then as an adult, he discovers that he's gay or bisexual or he's just a man who enjoys having sex with men. And one of the things he really enjoys is giving fellatio to his partners. Now imagine the conflict, imagine the distress that a man like this might present within your office when he comes in and just with quite a bit of shame acknowledges, well, there's this thing that I really enjoy doing. It's really erotic for me, and I get really turned on, but it's kind of similar to this thing that happened. Is there a link between the two? So that's often the question. They want to know, is there any link between this thing happened to me? It's the idea of trauma repetition, meaning that are they reenacting some element of their trauma as an adult that's sort of unfinished or unconscious or left over from their sexual abuse experience? There's a class of people that really would like to champion that idea, but those people tend to be a little more heterosexist, a little more heteronormative. They don't seem to be as welcoming of the diversity of sexual expression, welcoming things like polyamory or fetishes or kinks. So there just isn't a lot of good research showing that. And part of where we see this is if you look at the BDSM community, the folks that are interested in power exchange or the exchange of pain, if you look at the correlates of sexual abuse within that population compared to the general public, there's no difference. So if that theory was actually true, you would look at the BDSM community and say, oh, there must be a much higher correlation of sexual abuse, which is why those people are drawn to those particular things. But that just isn't the research just doesn't bear that out. There's really no difference in the statistics. So that theory doesn't actually hold a lot of water, even though a lot of people like to hold on to that theory, even though the research doesn't back that up. So clients are often very conflicted if they have an erotic interest that in some way mirrors or parallels their abuse experience. And, you know, I really try to work with clients around seeing if they can find a way to take ownership for what's erotically pleasurable for themselves without it having to have a link, you know, to something that was traumatic for them or that was distasteful for them. Because just because something looks the same, you know, you have a mouth, you have a penis, you have two men, you know, you have those three elements. Okay, those are all the same, but think about all the things that are different there. You've got two consenting partners. You have two people that are actually engaged and enjoying the experience. You have willing participants. You may have a conversation beforehand about requesting, this is what I'd like to do, or would you do this for me? So when you're trying to compare similarities and differences, there are so many more differences than similarities. Really, the only similarity is, okay, it's a similar body part, and you've got two men of the same gender. But everything, look at all the other things that are so different. So I really try to work with clients around, first, to see if they can release some of the shame that they have around the fact that they have excitement around something that's similar to what they experienced in their history, their abuse history. But then the process of really claiming it as their own and finding a way to really enjoy it and integrate it into their erotic self so that it doesn't have to be, they don't have to feel conflicted about engaging in it.
That makes so much sense because we have lots of people that do experience sexual pleasure that's been connected to the abusive behavior.
Yeah.
The part that they enjoyed it and if you know you've said this, but I've also heard clients say if I derive any enjoyment out of life, there's something wrong with me because it carries over into the overall life.
Right.
And so that any positive experience becomes a source of suspicion, maybe even self-doubt, mistrust, shame, lots of fear, because it opens up the possibility of abuse.
Right, that's right.
And even, Mark, if we look at some of this through the lens of attachment theory, and I think both of us use attachment theory because what we want in an adult partner is somebody who's responsive to us. Well, first of all, who's available to us and then responsive if we're upset and can help us, and it can help us calm down.
I would challenge that just a little bit because the men that I work with, I often find that that's one thing that they want, but I also find men... I find a great diversity of men in their sexual expression. So I might find men that actually want multiple attachments, meaning they may want to be in a polyamorous relationship, polyamory meaning many loves, meaning having a primary partner and then a secondary partner that is both a sexual and a romantic partner. So the attachment there may be split between two different partners versus somebody, let's say, who's more in the asexual umbrella, but asexual only in the sense, not in the traditional sense of I don't want any sexual expression or contact. There's a subsection of folks that actually really enjoy being sexual and having sexual expression, but they don't want to have it with anyone else. They don't want to have any relational or interpersonal sex. So for those folks to find a voice and to find a community or find acceptance in that this is how my sexuality works for me, and their primary attachment may be a self-attachment. It may not be with another person. So I guess rather than disagree with you, I just want to add to what you're saying. Yes, I think for those that want a healthy attachment, that's a wonderful thing to aspire for, but there's quite a range of what folks want, and not everybody wants a monogamous attachment with one individual. And I think as a culture, we're starting to come around to that just a little bit more and allow people to challenge this idea that I should have one partner for life and all of my sexual and companionship needs should be met in one individual. That certainly works for some. It just, I don't believe it works for everyone. And I think we're starting to make a little bit more allowance for different kinds of relationship configurations.
And I think that that's a healthy thing, but one wants to be very conscious about it.
Yes, very intentional, for sure. So there's one last thing that I wanted to cover while we still have a little bit of time here, and so back to the idea of men reclaiming healthy sex after sexual abuse. One of the things that can happen at near the end of treatment is if I'm working with somebody who's had a very high sex drive, there's somebody that maybe initially sexualized a lot of relationships and people and environments, and as they go through the process of therapy, they learn actually, oftentimes this is a result of not having good affect regulation skills, meaning the ability to soothe themselves or calm themselves when they're in an agitated or an anxious or a fearful state. So they learn how to do that much more effectively and find that they don't need sex to do that as they did when they start treatment. So some men get near the end of the process and they find they still have a very, very active and robust libido, a very high libido. So they go out and they're very easily visually stimulated. So this can be distressing for some clients that maybe find that they're not using sex to soothe themselves anymore, but they're finding they still have a lot of sexual energy. So as a sex therapist, one of the things I really like to rely on and lean heavily upon is the good sexual science and research that we have available to us. So the Kinsey Institute has a wonderful measure on their website that's called the Dual Control Model of Sexual Response. And what it is it looks at excitability and inhibition as two primary ways that people regulate sexuality. So you have low, medium, high exciters. In other words, some people that need a lot of stimulation because they're just naturally a low exciter. So they could look at erotic imagery, not get very turned on. Somebody could talk to them. They could use sex talk. It still couldn't be very arousing. But if their genitals were stimulated manually, that might be the thing that they need because they're just naturally a low exciter versus somebody who is naturally a high exciter. They go out in the world, they drive down the road, they see a billboard with an attractive person on it, they're immediately stimulated. Understanding, you know, how naturally excitable you are can be really helpful for clients. Because I deal with a lot of the hypersexual men, I have a lot of clients that take this measure and they come away saying, I'm a high exciter. You know, I never knew that I'm a high exciter. And you can't imagine the relief they have when they can just look at me and say, I'm not an addict. There's not something wrong with me. I'm just a high exciter. And I say, that's right. You're a high exciter. So you're going to have to learn how to manage being a high exciter differently in the world than other people. You're not going to be able to go into super visually stimulating environments without some kind of forethought or preparation or maybe some kind of negotiation with your partner or your spouse, because you're going to respond very quickly and very intensely to these kinds of stimulations. So I think it's important as part of the work that we do to educate our clients about, you know, how naturally inhibited are you? Maybe if you're somebody who's not very inhibited, well, you're going to have to be a little more careful about what you do and where you go, because that space between impulse, that impulsive thought and the action is going to be very low for somebody who has a low amount of inhibition. they're going to have to learn how to delay their responses and to have more impulse control, as opposed to the person that's highly inhibited. They're much likely, less likely to be impulsive and to just do things and regret them later, because they've got a natural inhibitory response where they just naturally go, whoa, you know, I don't want to do that, or I don't know, like, should I do this? They naturally move slowly towards things. So knowing how naturally inhibited you are and how excitable you are can be really, really useful for our clients to know.
So how can people, I know you're going to spend a few minutes talking about resources, but, and this comes under that heading, so how can people access this Kinsey dual control model?
Sure, sure. The Kinsey Institute, if you go to the Kinsey Institute website, and I don't think I have that right in front of me, but if I did, you can Google Kinsey Institute, and you can go to their website, and then you can look up, you can type in dual control model of sexual response. You could probably Google that just as easily and find that measure. It's an online measure that you can take that will give you the results at the end. It will show you there's two scales of inhibition and there's one scale of excitability. You can print this out, and then you can have some information about just understanding your own body a little more accurately. So that's something that's fairly easily accessible. I also think that if you're somebody listening to the program and you've had a sexual abuse history, you might want to avail yourself of finding a therapist that has some training in working with sexual abuse recovery, or at the very least, post-traumatic stress recovery or trauma recovery. I think that can be a great place to start. One of my favorite websites is the Male Survivor website, which is www.malesurvivor.org. And they're a wonderful nonprofit organization that has a lot of great resources for adult male survivors, including retreats that they do several times a year. They have ongoing chat rooms where you can go and talk to other survivors. And they're actually moderated chat rooms, so they've got someone that is there in kind of a safety function to keep those virtual spaces safe for these men to talk to each other. They've got book referrals. They've got a link on their site about how do I find a qualified therapist. The last thing I would say about resources as far as books, my favorite book for men is probably Mike Lew's book, last name L-E-W.
Yeah.
He wrote a book called Victims No Longer, and the second edition is it's just a classic, really wonderfully written book about helping men that are brand new to this process, or even men that have known about this but haven't ever delved into it, to educate yourself and continue with the healing process. There's a book called The Courage to Heal. Go ahead.
The Courage to Heal, yeah.
Courage
well,
to
I
Heal.
Well, I wanted to comment that
yeah.
Victims No Longer is excellent, Mike Lew, as you said, and then The Courage to Heal by Ellen Bass. These are
yeah,
very
and the
good
thing
books.
The thing I would say about The Courage to Heal, it's written by two women, and it's written really for female survivors, so you have to work a little bit with the pronouns, but if you can just read it and read it as if it was written for you as a man, I still think it's an excellent book. But just know that it was written for a female audience, but I think it's very applicable to men. And they wrote a companionate book called Allies in Healing, and that's for the partner. If you're the spouse or a partner of someone who's been sexually abused, this is the book for you. It's a great resource to learn and to understand your partner's perspective. And then the last book is Wendy Maltz's book, The Sexual Healing Journey. I think this is a great book for survivors. That's another great resource.
And would you spell her name? Because I'm not mixed.
Oh,
there's
M-A-L-T-Z.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Yes, you're welcome. Great to talk to you, Diana.
Great to talk to you. An hour filled with lots of good information.
Cosa leggerai? Con che libro affascini il tuo cuore? E se ti perderai nel labirinto di un amaro autore?